Hi, my name is Sarah Gilmartin. I'm an Irish writer and my book is titled Service.
Sarah Gilmartin's book, Service, is a work of fiction told through two oscillating timelines in Ireland, in 2017 during the rise of the Me Too movement and, retrospectively, 10 years prior. Gilmartin skillfully captures the voices of the three primary characters, giving equal time to Daniel, a successful chef who is accused of sexual assault, his wife, Julie, and Hannah, who worked as a server at Daniel's restaurant a decade prior. I recently spoke with Sarah Gilmartin about Service, which goes on sale in the U.S. today. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Sarah Gilmartin. So, Service takes place in Ireland during the rise of the Me Too movement. Can you set the scene for us? How would you describe this book?
So really, it's a story about the abuse of power in a buzzy, high-end Dublin restaurant at the height of the Celtic Tiger, which we called in Ireland, it would be known more generally as the boom, maybe in America. So around 2007. So there was an awful lot of money pumping into Ireland at that time. There was an awful lot of excess and riches. And I suppose there was also an awful lot of opportunity and possibility, and that's reflected in the world of the restaurant and the characters who work there. So there's three narrators in the book, and there is a waitress, Hannah, who worked in the restaurant the summer she was 21. There's the Michelin-starred chef, Daniel Costello, and then also Daniel's wife, Julie. So within these three characters, issues or themes appropriate to Me Too kind of come up, though at the time they're not called Me Too because it's 2007. But there are two strains to the narrative. So we have the 2007 one set in the restaurant, and then also 10 years later when Me Too is starting to become such a thing that will go on to become such a huge global cultural movement.
I want to talk about these three perspectives and how you were able to use each as a vehicle for the book. Let's first start with Hannah. As you mentioned, she's 21 when she works in this restaurant. It's been 10 years since she worked for Daniel. And we hear about restaurant culture through her chapters, which are, I'm assuming, told through, you know, a retrospective.
Yes. So in general, so even before this book, I like books that have nuance and a level of depth and kind of ambiguity. And I think one of the oldest ways in fiction to tell a story that has depth is to take the same events essentially and tell them from, you know, different sides, different perspectives. But particularly for this story, for a story that contained abuse, power, issues of consent and complicity, it felt necessary that there would be more than one voice. So each of the three voices is equally weighted. They each have the same number of chapters, roughly the same number of words, because I really want the reader to, you know, get to know the characters and make up their own minds. You know, there's no, I didn't want to push anything on the readers from my own perspective. So with Hannah, she had a great time in the restaurant. She absolutely loved it. It was one of, you know, the first times she'd ever been around. She's a college student in Trinity and she works there during the summer. And it's the first time she's ever been around money, riches, famous people, everything like that. So she has a ball until one day or one night after a particular busy service and a crazy party at the restaurant, something happens and everything changes for her. So her narrative is retrospective. So she's looking back 10 years later on her time there. And the reason for that, well, it's, you know, partly because I wanted her to be our guide through the restaurant, but also it's reflective of, I think, the nature of trauma in that, you know, often even though people tend to move on with their lives in a day-to-day sense, they can get stuck back at a particular time when something traumatic happened to them. And they may think that they're moving forward, but often it's as if they're like on a treadmill or something like that, where they're just they keep getting shunted back to that particular time. So she's retrospective for those reasons. And then with Daniel, who was the last narrator I kind of came to, I had envisioned the two women first. And I thought, no, this story is not balanced unless I have Daniel as a narrator as well. He was a really interesting character for me to write. I found him very charismatic. You know, for much of his book, he's now in his late 50s. He's celebrated. He's renowned in his field. He's won loads of different awards. And because Ireland is quite a small country in one way, he has, you know, he's really known about the place. So he's got this kind of false sense of humility that's quite, I found quite entertaining to write, where, you know, he's pretending to be kind of a man of the people. But really, you know, he doesn't really think that. He does think he's a little bit special. And then there's another, I suppose you would say, darker level to Daniel too, where I don't know if you would call him a predator. I mean, he certainly wouldn't view himself in those terms, but he is certainly somebody who's driven, who's ambitious, who admirably went into the industry from nothing. You know, he didn't come from a wealthy background and went in at 15 and worked his way up. But he has elements of the narcissist about him, as many driven people do who get to the top of whatever their chosen careers are. And, you know, he views other people in the restaurant and sometimes in his private life, not necessarily as human beings themselves, rather as tools to help him achieve his aims or to quell his desires or insecurities or whatever. So that was interesting too, to kind of delve into. And then finally, the third narrator is Julie, Daniel's wife. And really, when I was reading a lot about Me Too, you know, in the papers or online, just when it was all kind of breaking across the various different sectors, not just hospitality, I thought to myself that the voice that you rarely hear from is, you know, the voice of the person who's accused or who has been convicted on these charges. You know, there was these kind of images of women who were either wives or partners, very much in the background and often, you know, eyes cast downwards. And I thought to myself, God, you know, what would it feel like to be in that position? And from there, Julie's kind of voice was born, because whenever there's a gap, I find as a writer, whenever there's that kind of lacuna or absence, it's interesting to delve into that because you want to see what that voice might say.
You know, when you were talking about Daniel Costello and how he views himself, you know, his chapters, they are very internal, and we are seeing him through himself, through his own eyes. There were parts that I marked, like when he talks about the restaurant business, when he says, "There have been casualties, and I regret some of them." Or he talks about how he passes busy traffic by driving in the bus lane and just like fully admits that internally. Or he says internally, "It is a truth we are no longer allowed to speak out loud. God made women to comfort man." And even Julie describes Dan by saying, "You were too full of your own stories, your voice set to megaphone inside your head while the rest of us whispered asides." And I'm sure this was your intent, but I didn't know if I was seeing the world through the eyes of a rapist, or if chefs, I mean, just he was that arrogant of a man.
Yeah, and I mean, that was literally my intent, to kind of interrogate that. So from Daniel's perspective, nothing, he has done nothing wrong. And he doesn't really understand that. I think maybe as he gets towards the end of the book, and again, I don't want to give any spoilers, you know, he has an idea that he's going to lose something. And that is maybe getting him to think that, you know, certain things or certain ways that he has behaved may not have been hugely appropriate in light of what we are now understanding to be Me Too and all of those kind of things. But certainly back when they happened, you know, he's not just, it's not just himself, he's part of a culture in Ireland, as with other various patriarchal cultures in the 20th century, where, you know, there was a great sense of ownership. Men had a great sense of ownership about what was due to them, what they owned, how they could operate, how they could move through life. And I think there's been a huge kind of shift in that space over the last 5 or 6 years, and because of Me Too, and maybe even longer than 5 or 6 years. You know, I don't think it's all just happened in 20, since 2017. I think there's kind of been a slow awakening in Ireland, really, since the noughties into the second half of the, whatever you call the, after the noughties, but before the 20s, which I always forget, that decade. You know, things were shifting then. In Ireland, we had socially and culturally huge referendums, where we were a country that abortion was always forbidden, always banned, always illegal. If you needed an abortion as a woman, you had to get a boat and go to England. Up until, I think it's 2018, we had the referendum. It has since changed. The referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment on abortion passed. Similarly, with gay marriage, it was illegal to be gay in Ireland. First of all, outright to be gay in Ireland up until 1992. And you were not allowed to get married in Ireland as a gay person until 2015. So there has been, within the last 20 or 30 years in Ireland, just huge, big differences in what we accept to be what we consider to be okay.
There were a couple of other things that kind of captured my attention as far as like the differences between America and Ireland. There were references to the Me Too movement in America throughout the book, but there was a statement by Julie that said, "I'm thankful there are different rules here, that the papers aren't allowed to speculate, that they can only print the rudimentary details until a verdict is reached." And then also in your author's note, you explained that the Irish legal system has many obstacles that make the reporting of rape and sexual violence offenses incredibly difficult for the victim. Can you talk about those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's two kind of different things going on. So actually, the first thing is our legal system is different from the one in the UK and quite possibly the one in the US too, where when there is a trial going on and it involves sexual abuse of any kind, rape, sexual abuse of children, anything like that, it's all done behind closed doors and nobody in the media is allowed to report on it. And the reason for that is it protects the name of the person who's accused. So it's viewed in Ireland that if somebody who is accused of a crime like that gets off, their name should not be tainted with that crime. And in one way, it also protects the victim. So the person going through who has gone through all of the terrible things doesn't have to put their name in the paper unless they want to. So the victim, if the person is found guilty, then has the choice at the end of the case to say, I'm going to come forward and speak. And if that happens, then the accused and convicted accused name would be mentioned. But if it doesn't, it won't be. And I actually think that's quite a good system. They're looking, I think, to change it in the north of Ireland at the moment, because that system is more based on the UK one. There was a very high profile case in around 2018, 2019 up there involving some rugby players. And the girl who was on trial was literally on trial, not just in the court, but also in the court of public opinion, in the media, on social media. So it's about trying to make things less traumatic for people who have already been abused. So that's one thing. But it did make it difficult as a writer, just from a fictional perspective, because I wanted the knowledge to be out there in the world, because particularly for Julie and for Daniel, you know, they're being treated differently since these stories have emerged. So in a way that also reflects reality, I think, though, that even if things can't be reported in traditional media, quite often we're seeing these days, you know, they get out for a time on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. So that's kind of how I spun it in the book. But I suppose the bigger point at the end in that author's note was that the material events of the book. So there's another waitress. So I don't want to confuse readers, but there's another waitress called Tracy in the kind of contemporary 2017 timeline. And she has alleged that Daniel has raped her in a contemporary timeline, which is why Hannah is thinking back on her summer 10 years previously. So there's a trial regarding that. Tracy has been, I suppose, I would say, lucky enough to get her case as far as a trial, because quite often in Ireland, what happens is that, first of all, the rape may not be reported because it's quite a difficult process to go through. It can be arduous, it can be long, there can be really a lot of delays. The onus is really all on the victim in the current system in Ireland. And secondly, you know, even if it does get reported, the number really, really drops between the numbers reported and the number that actually make it into a court case, the numbers that are prosecuted. And then that number just nosedives again when it looks at in terms of conviction rates. I can't remember the exact year, but one of the recent years, 2021 or 2022, there's statistics from the Rape Crisis Centre, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, where the conviction rate for rape cases the previous year was 2%. So if you're a victim of sexual abuse or rape, and you think that those are your odds of getting a conviction, you can understand why a lot of people choose not to report it in the first place, which is a problem.
You mentioned that Dan and Julie were treated differently once word kind of got out. And at one point, Julie mentions that she was gifted a book written from the perspective of the spouse of a rapist. Did you, you know, run into any similar books like that during your research when you were preparing to write from her perspective?
A lot of what I read research level was more in the media, because I tend to, as a writer, generally just steer away from other fiction books that are like what I'm writing, just in case, you know, it gets murky or, you know, sometimes you have a great idea and you're like, that's a great idea, but actually you figured out that it's in a book that you read a couple of months ago. And sometimes you can still kind of, you know, use some of it, but a lot of the time it just kind of warps what you already have, or it confuses you as the writer. Years beforehand, I had read Mary Gaitskell's story, This Is Pleasure, in the New Yorker. And I love Mary Gaitskell's writing anyway, but I was so blown away by that story. What she did, I don't know if your readers know it, but it's basically a story about a powerful New York editor, a guy called Quinn. And he is accused in a kind of court of public opinion as well. Loads of women kind of sign a document saying that they've had altercations with him. And it's not very clear cut in the way that, Mary Gaitskell's stories are never clear cut. She really writes into that kind of murkiness and ambiguity that, it's not necessarily, a rape charge or something like that. It's more kind of lower level, but kind of still really insidious behavior. And the story is told from his perspective, but also, and I think crucially, from the perspective of his best friend, no-nonsense female friend called Margot, who's super smart, really intelligent, and is on his side for quite a lot of the story. She's like, these women are nuts. And it's kind of her slow dawning over the course of this wonderful long story that makes for such interesting reading, I think. So yeah, that was definitely something that, had stayed in my mind before I wrote Service.
I want to ask a couple of questions about craft, I suppose. Can you talk to me about, we know the story, we hear it through three voices. Can you talk to me about capturing the unique voice of each character?
The way Service began actually was a friend of mine who is an Irish actress, Lynette O'Callaghan. She asked me to write. She was going to do an audition for The Abbey, and she wanted a piece that was, I think they had to have a piece that was original and new and by an Irish writer. So I wrote what went on to become the opening page of Service for her audition. So it was literally, a monologue. It was in the voice of a female character, this waitress, Hannah. And it had that energy of a monologue. And it was only when I kind of finished it, I was like, this has legs. There's something in this. And I had been, as I said, reading a lot about Me Too at the time. So I kind of, those ideas dovetailed. But I suppose because one, my first novel, Dinner Party, is different. It's told in a third person pass, more of a classic kind of sense of how you would tell a story. So this was new for me, this kind of voice-driven story, but I have to say I really enjoyed it. I have a bit of like amateur acting background, so I kind of just went with it in the same way that you would maybe imagine a character or imagine a voice if you were going to act it on stage. And I have to say, yeah, I didn't find it difficult. Not even. I thought maybe with Daniel I'd struggle, but one of the things I did with Daniel in one of the early drafts, I had about 20,000 words, I think, that was Daniel talking about his past. So it was in the past when Daniel was like a boy of 10 and then he was a teenager. So it was kind of showing he was talking about him coming up. We saw him kind of coming up through the ages. And I realized at a certain point in a later draft that, the 20,000 words were good, but they had no place in the story I was trying to tell in the novel. So after like about a week of huffing and puffing and hating the book and the process and writing, I thought, okay, I'm going to cut this. And it killed me at the time, but actually it really stood to me then when I went to try and write more from Daniel's perspective as an adult, because I had all that kind of just knowledge to hand because I'd done the work beforehand. So in a way, I kind of think my brain tricked me into doing the 20,000 words just so I would be able to write Daniel as an adult.
I was interested also in point of view because, Daniel's his first person, but it's very internal and he's only thinking about himself. Julie's is in second person speaking to Dan, and then Hannah's was first person about Daniel. Can you talk to me about your intention with point of view for each of these characters?
Sure. So with Hannah, I suppose to say, first of all, to say she's in first person and it's retrospective a lot of the time. And I know she's talking about Daniel for quite a lot of the time because, the trial and the story has made her think about it. But also for a lot of the time, and probably more of the time, she's talking about the restaurant and how much she loved the restaurant and the world and how exciting it was. So I think sometimes one thing I want to guard against is that, sometimes people think, oh, they read the back of the book and they're like, this is going to be a bleak, very serious, grave story. And it was my intention going into it that it wouldn't be, because quite a lot of what Hannah experienced in the restaurant was just loads of fun and she had a great time. So, there's a bit of both. But from a writer's point of view, I wanted to be able to differentiate stylistically between the two female voices. So, you know, Daniel's a male, so that obviously makes him different in one respect, and even the way he's speaking. But I didn't want to have both Julie and both Hannah in the same first person. So I thought that Julie, because a lot of the time in the action of the novel in 2017, you know, outwardly, she's not saying very much to Daniel at all. It's all going on in her head. So she's going to court with him. She's there beside him. She's holding his hand for a lot of the novel. But inside her head, she's absolutely seething. I mean, she's furious. And she's kind of reeling as well. And a lot of that rage is turned inward. And it's also very much turned towards Daniel. So she's asking all these questions of him, of their marriage, of the last, you know, 25 years they've been together. You know, how can it be possible that, you know, one reality was going on in her head and in their marriage, and apparently a whole other reality was going on too. So it worked for me with that level of fury and that level of kind of confusion for her to be, you know, dictating almost her narrative inside her head to Daniel.
One more question about Daniel, then we'll let him go. He repeats a phrase throughout the book, "What is a chef?" and answers it differently each time, you know, always with an answer that can be taken literally or metaphorically. Can you talk to me about this question that he continues to ask?
I think I just wanted something. I thought it worked nicely from a writer point of view, from a craft point of view, to have something that would link through. You know, I know as a reader, I like that kind of thing, you know, where little repetitions kind of come up in books, and it's gratifying for the reader because you're like, oh, I remember that from, you know, the previous chapters or whatever. But also, I suppose it reflects Daniel's nature, that he is the third thing that's going on with Daniel, I suppose, is that, like, for the first time in his life, in his late 50s, he's had to stop because his restaurant is currently closed as they prepare for the trial. And this is a man who's been working 16-hour days for most of his life since he was a boy. And in the kind of same way that I sometimes think of when I look at footballers, you know, who have been taken from, particularly in the UK soccer system, they're often taken when they're like 13 or 14, scouted, put into a team, built up, suddenly given multi-millions, just beyond the money. And you or I or any normal people, I'm sorry, you could be a multi-millionaire, I have no idea. But if you are, or if you're not, you know, these kids are given like all this success and multi-millions. And then suddenly they come out the other end at 33 and they've got all this, but also they've got no life skills because they've never had the chance to learn them. You know, they've gone from being a child into a really kind of strange, privileged, structured world. And in a way, that's true of Daniel as well. So this is the first time in his life where he's not a man given to self-reflection, say, very well. You know, he's all about action. He's kind of about going forward. So in a way, there's more than a whiff of kind of like midlife crisis of Daniel at the moment. So that kind of what is a chef is like, you know, what is my life? What is going on for me?
I read that your experience serving tables in New York partially inspired the novel. Can you talk about how that and this book came into existence?
Sure. So the book, I mean, the genesis of the book was probably a lot of things. As I've said already, research, observation as well is a big thing. And then a little bit of personal experience. The material events of the book, what happens in the book is fiction. But I did draw on my own experiences to build the world. You know, I mostly had a very happy time as a waitress, whether in America or Ireland, bar the odd run-in with a temperamental chef or 20. But, you know, I think that there's a timelessness and a generality to the story that anybody who has worked in service at any point will kind of relate to. And certainly readers have said that to me over here. But I suppose one of the things I really drew on was that kind of buzz and that sense of camaraderie and sisterhood that I found that when I worked particularly in America and New York and Long Island, almost like you're like a family, you know. In the States, you know, staff meal is called family meal. And there's that sense of really, you know, everyone being in the trenches together, that, you know, there's something almost military about it, you know, even in the way that a restaurant is run in that terms of hierarchy is quite military in style as well. And it's how things get done to a level that's precise and, you know, well done. So I drew on all that kind of from my experience. And, you know, also, even though personally I didn't have anything outright horrible happened to me in my life as a waitress. I have had various microaggressions, throughout those kind of exchanges when you're young and you are a female and you're serving men who are like 20 years, 30 years older than you, and they have loads of money, and they come down from, the city at the weekend to the Hamptons with their money and all their mates and stuff. Various things get said and done that, that shouldn't. And also things that you see or hear or things that you glean that you feel by osmosis, when you're in the middle of service, when you're working and you don't have time to stop, because you've got to get another five plates from the kitchen, or, it's also busy when you're working in a restaurant. And then when the service is over, and I think this is key to the issue. It literally, the restaurant gets reset. All of the placemats get changed. We reset, we start again. It's a new day, it's a new night. Everything else gets swept under the carpet, So, yeah, things that just don't look right or seem right, but, somehow lodge in your brain and show up like, 15 years later. And I think also age is probably part of it too. So, when I was in my early 20s, even if I felt something was wrong, I don't think I would have had the language to be able to articulate it. I might have felt it in my head. But, time and getting to know yourself as a human being and getting to know how to articulate those thoughts is, one of the benefits of aging, I think.
Well, the book is Service. Sarah Gilmartin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth. It was an absolute pleasure.
That was Sarah Gilmartin, author of the book Service, which was published by Pushkin Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.